For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Pearly, and this is the African American Folklorist. In part one of my conversation with the American songster Dom Flemons about the significant contributions of African American musicianer Arnold Schultz, Dom gives us a glimpse of how Arnold influenced early bluegrass music. In part two, Dom shares the many genres that have benefited from the spark of Arnold Schultz.
Arnold Schultz is also teaching people new chords. So it's like, you know, whether he's a blues player or a jazz player or a ragtime player, this is a guy coming in and teaching a couple of new ideas to the larger community. And that changes everything. And then, you know, there's another guy named Tex Acheson, and he mentioned that he played with Arnold for a while, and he really enjoyed Arnold Schultz's playing, and especially the way that he played swing numbers. And that was kind of a way that he started to do his fiddling. And Tex Acheson would be part of a group called the Prairie Ramblers. And the Prairie Ramblers, they are one of the quintessential groups that started the Western swing movement because they backed up a woman named Patsy Montana, who made one of the first female cowboy hits, I Want to Be a Cowboy Sweetheart. And so these guys were the backup band, and their format translated out to Bob Wills and all the different Western swing bands. So all of a sudden, you see, like, now Arnold Schultz isn't just a singular influence on just Bill Monroe. He's now become this sort of the blues influence that permeates within a whole genre of music, you know?
Correct. No, I do understand. It's almost like he is the, I don't want to say ultimate, but the actual first to embody and polarize the studio musician, so to speak, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And if he had recorded or had been in the studio, that would change the whole conversation we're having right now. But since he was not a part of that, he's become another one of the mysterious influences of early country music that we tend to find. And, you know, with bluegrass music, it really made its way right to the radio. And so from there, you know, again, if you whether you're a black or white listener, you know, the string band music resonates in the same way. And so just by the nature of the times when it made its way to the radio, African-American string bands, I think, were so far removed from that tradition that I think, you know, by the time bluegrass music develops in of itself, it's so far away from African-American musical practices of that time that it would seem just a like a whole different world away from the old-time music that probably Arnold Schultz was playing.
Right. You know, what you just said reminded me of a scene from Black Bottom when the young man was saying, nobody want to hear that old jug band music. They want to hear the music of now. So that's pretty much what you're saying. It was a new era of music in the African-American space at this time.
Well, you know, even though we think of the 20s as being the past, you know, the records being made are literally up to date. And if people are presenting a very modern statement when they're making records, especially during the jazz era, the jazz age, when you have people like Johnny Dodds and some of these early Southern horn players beginning to make records, they're really bringing a very sort of a power. They're just bringing such a magnificently powerful statement into their records that people are hearing it through the speakers, and it's changing their whole outlook. And I think that in a certain way, the Arnold Schultz story is the combination, or it is a little bit of this outward story, because he traveled, so they know that he went places. But at the same time, he was very much a well-loved old-time country fiddler. And so he could really hold his own when he was breaking it down back at home.
Would you compare him to Leslie Riddle?
Well, the thing about Leslie Riddle, see, now there's a slight difference between their story, because Leslie Riddle is one step closer to the microphone.
Mm.
Now, the thing that I found interesting about Leslie Riddle's story, I recently got a lot of some information from a festival down in Burnsville, North Carolina, Riddle Fest. And one of the founders of the festival, Barry O'Connell, did a lot of research into Leslie Riddle's life. And it turned out that Leslie Riddle met A.P. Carter at the house of a fellow by the name of John Henry Lyons, who was a good friend of two men, Steve Tarter and Harry Gay, who as a duo were the single black act to record at the Bristol Sessions, known as the Big Bang of Country Music. And this was one of the first on-site Southern field recording sessions that they recorded many Southern acts. And this series of recordings was also the very first recording sessions for both Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family. And this session is what really put those two acts on the map for Ralph Peer, who would manage them both. But to find that Leslie Riddle is connected to the one black act that recorded during these same sessions, it then gave me a little bit of a stronger impression of A.P. Carter as a folklore-type entity looking for new song material that could be modified and copyrighted for the Carter family. And so he met Leslie Riddle, and they became great friends for a better part of half a decade. And, you know, I think in their part of Virginia, they were able to correspond and be good friends, and they allowed Leslie to stay with them. And they were just very cordial with each other during that whole time. And Leslie's influence with the Carter family is very, it tells a lot about the lasting legacy of strict segregation in the United States.
Mm.
Because in a certain way, you can see that A.P. Carter and the Carter family were able to get money from recording these songs and a portion of them being part of Leslie Riddle's repertoire. But at the same time, you can also see that the industry is being built. So there isn't necessarily a series of gigs or a circuit or a sure path to income with making recordings. So you can find that in Leslie Riddle's story, you can see that he found, you know, no real path to really finding a good way of living as a musician for his time. So you can see that he didn't really pursue being a professional compared to the Carters.
Right. And I hate to say it, but the reality of it is the Carters were able to make a living off of his repertoire, and he was not, because he was black.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But it tells you a little bit about social tolerance in terms of the way that the Carter family wanted to bring African-American folk songs into their repertoire. But it didn't help Leslie Riddle because, you know, the odds were against him. And it's very telling that in spite of anything, these odds were against both of them. And it just was, you could see that nothing was done to try to break those barriers.
Right. And as you explained that, I did see the difference between Arnold Schultz and Leslie Riddle, because he actually... Leslie, that is, was an inspiring recording artist where Arnold was not, right?
Yeah, and what's interesting is that, again, Leslie Riddle he began to see the value of doing music for a living once he met Mike Seeger in the early 1960s.
Right.
So you have to imagine in one way, because Leslie went to the church, and so the blues had an association with his past life that I don't think he necessarily wanted to be reminded of. So fast forward into 1963, Mike Seeger, he actually reaches out to Sarah and Maybelle Carter, and he and the New Lost City Ramblers begin to perform with Maybelle Carter, because at that time she was performing on Johnny Cash's show with her daughters, June Carter and Anita and Helen. And at one point, as Mike was interviewing her, he asked her about her guitar style. And she told him about Leslie Riddle. And so this is where the story begins to take shape, is that Maybelle Carter told Mike where she learned one of her songs, The Cannonball. And then later on, Mike Seeger also talked to Brownie McGee, the blues singer. And then Brownie told Mike where to go, which was Rochester. And Mike went out and visited Leslie Riddle in Rochester, New York, and began to interview him and ask him about his life. But Leslie had no interest in talking about his life as a blues man until Mike came around again. And once he saw that Mike, because Mike also made sure to pay people properly when they worked with him as just a, you know, as a code of conduct. And Leslie, he freed himself of the bitternesses of the past, I think, in a certain way. I think there was an association with the blues life that I just don't think he could apply that to his life moving forward. Not until he got a new perspective.
One thing, and I would like you to, as we begin to wrap up, expound upon. He had a nuance. He was able to socialize in black and white spaces, as well as elite spaces, right?
Yeah, that's one of the things they said, is that he was welcome in every home, in one part as a musician, another part because he made homebrew, and he was just a well-loved, larger-than-life individual. And that's one of those things that you find a lot as well. When it comes to music, you find that there are barriers that get broken, especially when a musician is highly acclaimed. But again, with Arnold Schultz's story, that's also part of his undoing as well, is jealousy. Again, it's another reminder of how far we've come, you know, in one way. And a reminder of some of the horrible discrepancies that people face.
Well, he was jealous, or people were jealous of him?
Well, you know, there are two sides of the story on it. One part of the story, because he died at the age of 45, and they say that he had a bad heart, but his family member attested that there were jealous musicians around him that had poisoned his whiskey. And apparently he was very fond of his whiskey, and that was part of his undoing, was that jealous musicians had poisoned his whiskey. In a very similar type of way, next to the Robert Johnson story, which is something that Keith Lawrence mentioned on our talk, that there's a very similar flavor to Arnold Schultz's story. But that's another one of those sad tales again.
I agree. As we wrap up, Dom, could you please do one favor for me? Because I'm really interested in the fact that the cousin of Arnold Schultz said that it was his black family playing hillbilly music. The reason why I'm interested in that, because outside of the Ebony Hillbillies, which is a current band that's been around for some years, are there many people that will associate African-American family bands to hillbilly music? Is that ordinary? Is that extraordinary? Are those isolated families?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting because in some ways it's like the larger string band families tend to sit in a period of time when the communities were a little bit more spread out. I'll say it that way. I think about the other big string band family I can think of, the Snowden family, who were out in Ohio around the 1870s and 1880. No, I guess it would probably be a little before that. No, probably the 1860s. They were a string band family, a large family, and they were said to be the family that wrote the song Dixie, and they knew Dan Emmett, Daniel Decatur Emmett, who's the fellow who's known for having written the song Dixie. But they were part of this sort of, you had this period of time where I think where you just had, as a result of post-slavery life, you had large family, you know, family plantations, and you had large family plots where you could have a large string band come up And I think that that's something that was just a part of the era. I think that, that there were just a lot of major metropolitan cities that had musical programs. And I think that that's something that also was a part of each of the communities. I think there were small musical education programs that were around in these smaller rural communities that I think continued to, you know, fuel musical training and musical development. And that's one of the reasons I think a lot of these string bands can continue to flourish. You read about some of the different families, like the Chapman family from Mississippi, who the Mississippi Sheiks, and Bo Carter and Sam Chapman are all a part of. They were part of a big family. But I think that a lot of those family bands, I don't think that those groups ended up... I just don't think they had commercial appeal for the early record companies. And I think that, again, I think a lot of the early records we hear are coming from more of the cutting edge and modern practitioners of each of these different traditions. And I think that that's something that, I think if we did more research, we'd find more big string bands type of situations more so than smaller groups.
Well, you know, I believe I asked this question in reverse. I should have asked you this first in this segment only because the description that you're using is string bands, family string bands. And this has been the ongoing description through our conversation. So for the audience, what actually constitutes a hillbilly band? And is it synonymous to a string band?
Well, you see, the thing is, the term hillbilly, based on who you talk to, see, now, hillbilly sort of is a pejorative term. And so I don't tend to like to say hillbilly a bunch of times because I would hate to offend anybody who wouldn't want that term used. But a lot of, like when I say string band music, I usually mean the same type of music. And of course, early string band, old time and hillbilly music was marketed. And the term hillbilly was the marketing term for the music as well. So a lot of time when people say hillbilly, it has a certain connotation to a rustic, old-fashioned sort of, and sometimes sort of corn-tone type of southern way of living. And also, if you imagine an African-American version of that, there's a whole other different type of popular performance style that is another very infamous style, the Blackface Minstrel Show, which it runs side by side with sort of this corn tone humor. And so, a lot of this early string band music, it has this sort of, there's a self-effacing quality to it because it's like a music like the blues, it's a music that's meant to overcome the odds that are being placed against you. And so a lot of this old time music tends to do that. It tends to flip the script on the prejudices laid upon them by the powers that be. And a string band music is just about the same, you know, it's a polite term.
I dig it. Me personally, that's very intriguing because when you think about a lot of these naming conventions that become marketing tools also are utilized as weapons towards these communities that transmit these traditions, regardless of ethnicity or so-called skin color, right?
Absolutely. Well, and since our conversation started on bluegrass, one of the things that has always has been a prominent feature of the bluegrass genre is that most of the bands usually are wearing really nice suits, and they're usually called hat acts. One of the things about bluegrass is a lot of times the bands are really well-dressed, and so they sort of well-dressed sort of in a string band or old-timey version of like how a blues band would be dressed. And so there's a certain, there's a certain dapper quality to bluegrass that it permeates the whole style. And that goes all the way back to Bill Monroe and all of the pioneers. And that's a piece of it as well that differentiates it from a lot of the older style of music that preceded it. And you see the bluegrass bands and the Western swing bands, you can see that they start to dress down a little bit of the, sort of the patches and the patches in the shirts and that type of stuff. Because again, when they first marketed a lot of this, old timey music, it was they made all the acts dress up like like they were hillbillies and with blacked out teeth and things like that. But once bluegrass began to take hold, that was one of the ways in which people begin to class up and sort of do their own sort of, again, sort of a dapper, debonair type of attire and dress. And so then the solos and the sort of the musical phrasing began to get more sophisticated as well. And so it started to take on this whole other quality. But again, when you start to bring the idea of someone like an Arnold Schultz into the picture, and at least, Arnold Schultz is bringing this new idea of a new way to approach music, or even attack the notes, or who knows what else. It's amazing to see that trend then creates this beautiful blend of music that's, that makes it something a little bit different.
This guy really kind of not only set the tone, but sparked a thread that he's part of that just went in so many different avenues, for lack of better.
Absolutely. And so it's been interesting for me to continue to hear more about Arnold Schultz, because I find myself thinking more like how I think of my jazz history when I think of like what happened when Lester Young came into the scene, and all of a sudden everybody wanted to do the Lester Young thing. If you had a saxophone, you did the Lester Young. And so you've got like a whole movement of people figuring out the phrasing, the solos, and everything like that. And I mean, what an amazing thought to think of string band music doing that. And again, you have to imagine people maybe using sheet music, but maybe not using sheet music, but jamming and really getting into some beautiful new creative thought processes,
I dig it. Sir, I appreciate your time as per usual.
Yeah, man, Jack Depp, I'm always glad to talk with you, and I'm so glad that you asked about Arnold Schultz. He's one of the most amazing mysteries of early country music, and potentially jazz and blues music too, based on which stories you read. But hopefully we continue to learn more about it. And also, talking with Dr. Richard Brown, the International Bluegrass Music Association, the IBMA, has launched its own Arnold Schultz Memorial Fund to help sponsor programming and to be able to help share the story of bluegrass with musicians of color, as well as be able to help unearth some of the stories of the diverse backgrounds of bluegrass music.
Thank you, Dom. For more information on the Arnold Schultz Fund, check out bluegrassfoundation.org. For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Pearlie, and this is the African American Folklorist.